The book, Finding Freedom by James Lowe, has three sections relating to three approaches to freedom: Theravada, Mahayana, and Dzogchen. The texts in each section are accompanied by a comprehensive introduction, which elucidates their meaning, value, and relevance. This recording is of the introduction to the Mahayana text, Sharp Weapon Wheel. For ease of use, the recording was made in five parts. Introduction to Sharp Weapon Wheel, Part 1. This famous text beautifully expresses the inclusive approach of Mahayana Buddhism, highlighting the inseparability of wisdom and compassion. It shows how seeing things as they truly are and acting for the benefit of all are the two wings of the bird that will fly us to enlightenment. All sentient beings are precious. All have the same ground or basis, which is itself the door to freedom. Yet they wander in samsara, activating dualistic intentions under the influence of the five poisons, namely, the opacity of mental obscuration, desire, aversion, pride, and jealousy. All sentient beings have been our mothers in previous lives, and so are equally deserving of our respect and care as we repay our debt of gratitude. There are no fundamental differences between sentient beings. The diversity of their forms is due to the ripening of their karma. This karma arises from attachment. Attachment arises from ignorance of the ever-open and available ground. This ignorance is adventitious and in no way contaminates the pure ground, which is the same for all beings. True concern for the welfare of beings is necessarily inclusive and not exclusive. To discriminate between beings, doing more for those we like and less for those we do not like, is to act to maintain samsara by privileging the delusion of duality over the actuality of non-duality. This is very challenging, since we have to overcome more than just our everyday biases towards those we care for and those we don't. Ethical concern for others who have been hurt often causes us to have a negative view towards those who torture, rape, exploit, and similarly harm others, especially if we say that torture is done by torturers, and that the term torturer really sums up who they are. This way of viewing strengthens our sense of the negativity, not only of the action, but of the person who acts. They are bad. So, should we help people like that gain enlightenment? Well, people like that have no defining inherent existence. Like everyone else, they manifest according to causes and conditions. Their seemingly fixed defining identity as torturer, rapist, terrorist, and so on is an idea arising in our mind. Their own karma will bring them suffering in due course. Our task is not to punish, but to see how the potential for enlightenment, present in all beings, is easily obscured by over-identification with the transient features of each current situation. All beings are potential Buddhas. They are not yet Buddhas. Buddhahood will manifest following the resolution of their confusion, the dissolving of their karmic tendencies, the ending of their wandering in samsara, and the ripening of their potential for unimpeded clarity and compassion. Moreover, as Shantideva says in Entering the Way of the Bodhisattva, Chapter 6, Verse 113, thus, Buddhahood depends on beings and Buddhas equally. Which tradition reveres Buddhas and not beings? Without sentient beings, there would be no one to become a Buddha. Without Buddhas, who would be able to help sentient beings awaken their own intrinsic Buddha potential and so gain enlightenment? To imagine that Buddhas are fundamentally different from the sentient beings who wander in samsara is a great mistake. Beings and Buddhas have the same source, and all our judgments and discriminations cannot alter this basic fact. Buddhahood is awakened to by the wisdom conveyed by the teaching of the Buddhas and by the compassion evoked by remembrance of both the potential of all sentient beings and the suffering they endure due to ignorance and karmic consequences. Cherishing all sentient beings, valuing their potential, and holding it as more important and definitive of them than their adventitious limitations and tendencies, awakens our own hearts to love and trust. Seeing that they are like us in wishing for happiness and in trying to avoid suffering, we can come to see that there is no basis for the judgments that we make about them and about ourselves other than our own mental constructs. Judgment is based on comparing and contrasting, setting this against that. For such an evaluation to occur, this and that need to be different. When we compare and contrast sentient beings, we do so not with regard to how they are in themselves, but solely with regard to our own interests and concerns. Which person can help me more? Which animal is more delicious for me to eat? This way of examining the qualities of others shows us ourselves, not them. Each and every sentient being is inseparable from emptiness and is therefore incommensurable. All have value, yet this is not the value we project into them and then imagine them to inherently possess, but rather it is the intrinsic value of emptiness, as set out clearly in the Heart Sutra. Not only are we all empty of inherent existence, and so devoid of an enduring, defining essence which could be judged to be good or bad, but the judging self is also an empty illusion, devoid of true authority. I and all beings wander in samsara due to unawareness of our own mind and the consequent delusion that self and other are really existent. From the single moment of the arising of the idea of an entity existing apart from the ground, there is a gradual development of the duality of self and other, and the attribution of individual existence and agency to both. The open source, the site of our Buddha potential, is never lost. It does not go away from us, nor we from it. The ignoring of the ground is the seductive presence of the idea of separateness. There is no actual division Yet the idea of self-existing entities develops due to misprisioning the openness. We see right through it without being aware that it is always present. The focus of our attention and desire is usually on the illusion of substance, made ever more real by our deluded belief in the reality of the separate entities we call self and other. This belief generates us in our individuality at the expense of freedom to relax. We, as pseudo-entities, are now trapped on the treadmill of continuous ego maintenance, relying on transient phenomena, both the seemingly outer and inner, to fill our empty self. Within this delusion, we believe in many different objects, animate and inanimate, and experience the apartness of myself, my mind, my body, my world. Due to this limited understanding, we generate some virtue with body, voice, and mind, and so temporarily inhabit the higher realms of gods, jealous warriors, and humans. We also generate some non-virtue with body, voice, and mind, and so temporarily inhabit the lower realms of animals, hungry ghosts, and hells. None of these realms are final destinations. Each can be experienced by us on the basis of the karmic tendencies which arise for us at the moment we exhaust the cause of inhabiting a form in one particular realm. We then experience a new ripening, arising as a consequence of an aspect of our accumulated karma, manifesting as identification with a new body and environment. Seeing that this is the case, if I accept that my experience is generated by my own mind, then there is no one else to blame for my situation. My life is not in the hands of others. Having been born in samsara, all that occurs for me arises from my own past and present actions. If I want freedom from the chain of repeated births, I will have to review my life and make the necessary changes. No one can do this for me. As the Dharmapada says, verse 165, by oneself alone is evil done. By oneself is one defiled. By oneself is evil avoided. By oneself alone is one purified. Purity and impurity depend on oneself. No one can purify another. Moreover, as Nagarjuna says in his letter to a friend, our liberation depends on us. No one else can achieve this for us. Therefore, by study, ethics, and non-distraction, strive to activate the Four Noble Truths. Although we vow to cease from causing harm to others and to work for their benefit and welfare, the help we can give is limited. Each sentient being has to awaken by herself or himself. This is because they themselves have to disengage from attachment to thoughts, feelings, memories, and all the other constituents of their deluded sense of self. Having done so, they need to awaken their love and compassion by reflecting on the suffering of others, and to dissolve all obscurations in the clarity of unobstructed emptiness. The mind is primary. When it moves, that is, when thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories, impulses, and so on arise in it, then everything appears and moves. The patterning of my voice and body arise from my mind. Mind is chief, and it is my mind, not as a possession of the ego self, but as the basic field of experience, that I, as mental consciousness, generating intentions, have access to. The ego is a content of the mind, and not the other way round. Mental consciousness can examine the ego, the sense of a continuous, permanent self that is cherished above all others. Is it truly what we take it to be? Is it who we truly are? Perhaps it is merely an unexamined assumption. We need to establish this for ourselves. Assumptions, or mental obscurations, are powerful, for they guide our experience and behaviour, whether they are actually valid or not. End of part one. From the book Finding Freedom, introduced and translated by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, March 2024.